This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. It's Father's Day weekend, and later in the show, we'll have stories that celebrate dads. But first, we have a story about two women. They're not professional athletes. They're not famous. They're just two friends. Back in the 1980s, Caroline Steer and Vanessa Oshima went to high school together in a small town in New Zealand.
It's called Metameta, so M-A-T-A, M-A-T-A.
That's Vanessa. She says when she and Caroline were in school together, they were both into sports. But Caroline remembers things a bit differently.
I was incredibly unfit. I was notorious for hiding from cross country, and I would have told you back then that I can't run. It's just an impossibility.
After high school, Caroline and Vanessa went to different universities. Vanessa moved to Japan. Caroline stayed in New Zealand. The two fell out of touch, as friends living apart sometimes do. 15, maybe 20 years went by before they found a reason to connect again.
It started with Caroline. She'd seen on Facebook that I had had a great day running, and she sent a message saying I was having a bit of a crappy day, but now I feel inspired to actually go out and try something. So I messaged back and said, well, hey, what's going on? And she said, well, I've just been diagnosed with cancer.
It was breast cancer.
The first chemo session kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. So I was thinking about diet and exercise and what can I do to make the whole chemo process easier. Just seeing her running was like, that's so awesome. Maybe that's, you know, like that's part of the puzzle.
I said, well, hold on, that's easy. If what, me running makes you want to go fight this? I'll run, and I'll run until you're done.
Vanessa promised to run every single day for Caroline, and jogging down to the end of the block and back wouldn't count. She'd run at least 5K, that's 3.1 miles, and she'd do it outdoors because running on a treadmill was just too easy.
People who are fighting cancer don't get to choose that. They don't get to say, oh, you know what, today I think I'll just treadmill it.
Vanessa's husband, Yasu, was a cancer survivor, so she knew she'd be at it for a while, maybe 2 or 3 years. Caroline says right from the beginning, it made her feel better to know that Vanessa was going to all this trouble for her, and she made her own promise.
To start off for me, it was 20 minutes every day of, for example, walking up and down my road. But over time, I actually started to run. Although my husband did describe my running at first as an animated wobble, but it was my animated wobble.
While Caroline was perfecting her wobble, Vanessa ran every day for 50 days, then 100. She'd post updates on Facebook using the hashtag OutRunCancer.
She was a big part of what got me through my dark time, my treatment and the tough time. She gave me something that really made me smile. You know, like I looked forward to her posts. What's Vanessa doing today? What's the next installment?
Soon, Vanessa started recruiting friends who wanted to outrun cancer too. They'd each commit to running every day for 50 days. And even though they'd never met Caroline, they all ran for her.
I remember one day, I think it was day 200, and we decided to do a run all together, and we ran in the park, and it was cherry blossom season, and we Skyped her because she was still in the middle of chemotherapy, and she cried on the Skype call, and she just, it's just amazing to know that people I don't know are doing this for me. I think that was when it started to hit us that we were doing something special.
Caroline finished chemotherapy and began hormone treatment on day 259. Vanessa kept running. She ran through injury. She ran through a typhoon. A year went by, then two, then three. Along the way, Vanessa raised $16,000 to fight cancer. After a while, even though she was healthy, Caroline wasn't able to keep up her daily runs or wobbles. Work and life got in the way. But on day 1,000, she flew to Tokyo, and she and Vanessa ran together.
And I'd always said to her, look, anything I can do ever, I'm here for you. And of course, if the same was to happen to you, I would run every day for you. to be honest, I always thought, no, Vanessa's so healthy, she'd never get anything like this.
But after more than 4 years of running every day to outrun cancer, Vanessa started to feel like something wasn't quite right. At first, she thought maybe she'd just pulled a muscle. But when the feeling didn't go away, she decided to go in for her yearly mammogram a little early.
The doctor immediately, as soon as she saw the mammogram, she said, this is not good. And I was like, what? What do you mean not good? And she goes, we need to do a biopsy on this one.
So by the time the biopsy came back, were you ready for bad news?
Oh, God, no. I was ready for good news. The doctor came back and she was so blunt, bless her soul. She goes, okay, so you have cancer. And I was like, oh.
Later that night, Vanessa called Caroline.
At about 11:20 at night, and we chatted, and you know, I tried to be as supporting as I could. And then I got my nightlight on my phone, and I went for my first run that night. It felt like the beginning for me all over. Just it took you back to, I know where she's at, I know what she's going through, and you know, I need to support her as well as she supported me.
At first, Vanessa says she tried to hide her pain from Caroline. Before long, she realized she didn't need to. When Vanessa had questions about what would happen next, she called Caroline. When she felt like she was going crazy, she called Caroline. Still, 2 days before she was scheduled for surgery, it all got to be too much. She was running in the park with her husband, and she started crying. She couldn't stop.
And he said, what's wrong? And I said, you know what? For 4 years, I've been using this hashtag, outrun cancer, and you can't outrun it. It catches you. It caught me. It caught Caroline. It caught you. I mean, so what's the point? It doesn't matter how we do this. I can raise all the money I want. I can't do it.
It was the closest Vanessa had come to quitting. But her husband, Yasu, encouraged her to try to keep going for just one more day. And soon, she wouldn't have a choice. Vanessa and her doctor decided on a radical mastectomy and lymph node removal. They hoped that with this surgery, Vanessa would be able to avoid chemotherapy. But her doctor said it would likely end the streak.
I think there would have been one thing if I'd, like, broken a bone or an injury, and it's like, okay, I'm stopping for injury. But the pain of the streak that was all about beating cancer is stopped by cancer. Just, it didn't sit well with me. But I needed to come to terms with that, and I kind of did. So I was almost at peace with ending it.
Vanessa went for a run at 4:30 on the morning of her surgery. When surgery was over, she sent her running shoes home with her husband. At 10 the next morning, Vanessa's doctor came in to check on her.
And she's like, well, you know what? You could be okay to do a slow jog indoors. You're not going outdoors. Be close to where the nurses are. Don't break a sweat. Don't use your arms. You'll be okay.
Vanessa immediately texted Yasu and asked him to bring her running shoes back. But for the rest of the day, she couldn't bring herself to put them on.
Cancer, for me at least, it shakes your confidence. You know, that you think you're this healthy person and then suddenly you're not. At 8:30, I thought, you know what? Let's try. And so I put on my sneakers and I ran 42 laps in front of the elevator bay. Backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. There were tears. I don't know if there were tears of sadness or elation or just tiredness, but there were tears and questions. Why am I doing this? Is this the right way to tackle this? Doubt. Yeah, so I wouldn't say it was a good run, but it was, I don't know, a small victory to say, you know what, cancer, you didn't stop me. Try again. So. April 1st, 2017. I have 1,663 days of running 5 kilometers per day.
Like with so many of her runs, Vanessa posted an update on Facebook. It ended with this.
One day I will not run. today was not that day. Hashtag Outrun Cancer. There's so much energy you have. You can use energy to find an excuse not to do something. I could give you 10 million excuses why I'm not going to run. You know, I'm got a busy day today. It's raining. I've got cancer. But yeah, I could give you 10 excuses to not run. All you need is one to do something. And I think Caroline became that one reason for me.
And Caroline, well, she couldn't keep her running streak going when she was only running for herself. But now that she's running for Vanessa...
I have run every day without exception. I'm still not a runner. There's no grace, there's no speed. I do my run each night and I come back feeling better for it.
She always used to say to me that it was really great having me run for her. And I thought that she was being nice, quote unquote. But now that I'm going through it, I get it. I wake up in the morning and I see on Facebook, hey, day 99, da-da-da, Outrun Cancer. And I get it.
Vanessa recovered from surgery without missing a day of running. She'll be on hormone therapy for the next 5 years. And she says she'll keep running until the day she comes back from a run and says to herself, it's not helping anymore. As for Caroline?
Well, her commitment to me was until I'd finished my treatment. And my commitment to her is the same, I guess. But, you know what? I'm kind of enjoying the run for the run's sake. So, I don't know. Part of me thinks, as long as you can run... run.
Friday was day 115 of running every day for Caroline Steer and day 1,739 for Vanessa Oshima. There will be a day when they do not run, but today is not that day. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. This is usually the time when we thank someone who's left us a review on iTunes. And although iTunes reviews really are a great way to help other listeners find our show, I'd like to take this moment to thank someone even more important. That last story came to us from a listener named Victor Ferreira, who saw a post by Vanessa Oshima on Facebook. He thought it would make a great story for our show, and I think it did. Some of our best story ideas come from listeners like Victor. So if you see something or hear something that you think we'd like, go ahead and email it to us. We're at oag@wbur.org. That's oag@wbur.org. And thanks. I'm Karen Given. Since last week, we have two new champions, the NBA's Golden State Warriors and the NHL's Pittsburgh Penguins. Both teams are now facing a huge question. That's where we'll start this week on Three Stories You Should Know. Joining me are Julie DeCaro, a host at Chicago's 670 The Score, and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Karen.
Hi, thanks.
Cindy, it's all you.
Well, you mentioned that there are two new champions. There is also a new president, someone may have noticed.
No.
And we've had a couple of champions, and this raises the question of, will teams go to the White House or not? We have seen the New England Patriots go. Tom Brady opted to stay away, and so did several other Patriots players. And now the Pittsburgh Penguins and Golden State Warriors are on the clock. The Penguins have said that they would go if invited. Now, the Golden State Warriors are another matter. The coach, Steve Kerr, has been outspoken in his criticism of the president. Stephen Curry has referred to him as an asset without the E and the T, shall we say. And the question is, what will the Warriors do? There have been reports that they have decided not to go, but Steve Kerr has shot that down. And I think that whatever happens here with the Warriors, if they are invited, they will tell you they haven't been invited yet. They will be leaders on this. And this is an important question, even though players have been going to the White House since the 1800s, and going to the White House is a form of respect for the office as opposed to the individual who might occupy it. Players have boycotted in the past. Players boycotted Obama. Whatever happens, there will be a statement involved with it, and it's going to be important.
I think that we have always worked out our issues as a country through sports, whether it's integration, you know, baseball integrated before the country integrated. Muhammad Ali brought the Vietnam War into everyone's living room. You know, we're talking about domestic violence and violence against women nationally, in large part because of Ray Rice and what happened in the NFL. So I feel like this is the kind of protest we should be encouraging athletes to do, nonviolent protests. If they don't want to go to the White House, I'm happy to have them not go to the White House, no matter what president it's for. I think if they decide as a team they're not going to go, then I think that's a pretty powerful statement.
Well, I absolutely agree on one thing, which is that I fully support an athlete's right to talk about things that aren't sports. I support an athlete's right to go or not go after an invitation has been received from the White House. I've got to say, all this speculation, though, really kind of rubs me the wrong way. I mean, without getting into who is exactly responsible for the lack of courtesy and respect in the political climate, who turns down an invitation before the invitation has arrived? You know, like, I don't think Emily Post would be okay with this. So while I'm like, yeah, sure, absolutely, make your stand, wait to make your stand until you've gotten the invitation.
Okay, that's a good point. That's true. Manners. One thing we need more of, manners. I'm for that.
Julie, your story comes to us from St. Louis. What's going on there?
Well, on July 30th, St. Louis is going to host Christian Night, which is something they've hosted for the last three decades. Now, it should be said they also have things like Jewish nights, nights for other religions, and they are going to be having an upcoming Pride Night. However, for this particular Christian night, they've invited Lance Berkman, former player, to come in and speak at their Christian night. Now, the problem is for many of the St. Louis fans, many of others around the country, especially the LGBT community, is that Lance Berkman has been extremely outspoken about being anti-LGBTQIA. He worked very hard to try to defeat an equal rights ordinance in Houston. This is one of those so-called bathroom bills that wouldn't allow transgendered women to go into women's bathrooms. He's also made several statements saying that society has become too tolerant of people's differences, saying, quote, to me, tolerance is the virtue that's killing this country. We're tolerant of everything. That was back in 2015. And that same year, the Cardinals had a minor league player named Tyler Dunnington who actually quit baseball altogether. And he said it was because of all the jokes about LGBT people and all the homophobia that he encountered in the locker room. And certainly this is not unique to St. Louis. I would venture to guess that every single team around the country has an LGBT player in their locker room, whether or not they know it. But it seems like a really poor choice of a person to come half speak on Christian night.
Yeah, it is a terrible choice. And it's also at odds with baseball's stance. You know, baseball has an ambassador of inclusiveness in Billy Bean. And they've tried to take steps to make locker rooms more inclusive, more relaxed, more tolerant. And to have Lance Berkman speak is really at odds with that. I'm kind of surprised that Major League Baseball hasn't said something to the Cardinals about it, because I know that in other instances, other leagues have, you know, not been hesitant to flex their muscles. For instance, in the 90s, the NFL moved a Super Bowl out of Arizona because Arizona hadn't recognized the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King as a holiday. And we all saw what happened with the NCAA and the NBA in North Carolina. The leagues actually have some power here, and I'm kind of stunned that they haven't done something here.
Yeah, I find it interesting. There seems to be a difference between what the league is saying and what the Cardinals are doing, mm-hmm. You know? Like, it's great that the leagues are trying to be inclusive of gay people who they know are in their locker rooms. But if you were a player and watching who the Cardinals were bringing in, what would you believe? What the league says or what your team is doing?
You know, it would be a great gesture if the Cardinals brought in Billy Bean to speak with Lance Berkman, a Bean and Berkman. You know, why not?
Absolutely.
You know, I think that as the amount of young men playing baseball, especially in the African-American community, is waning, you would think that maybe some of these throwbacks to sort of an older conservative generation would be something that baseball would want to move away from and move towards a more inclusive, you know, stance. But clearly that's not which way St. Louis is headed.
So I want to talk about a big announcement made this week that concerns college athletes. The National College Players Association has created a new document for recruits to sign instead of, or maybe in addition to, the National Letter of Intent. And everyone pretty much agrees that the National Letter of Intent, which schools and recruits sign now, does a whole lot more to safeguard the school than it does to safeguard the athlete. This new document is called the CAP, the College Athletic Protection Agreement. It offers multi-year scholarships, more stipend money. It obligates schools to pay for sports-related injuries. It would potentially give athletes the right to transfer schools. These are all great things. I have two kind of worries about it. One, it's totally voluntary. And if a school does sign it, they're only going to do it for the very, very, very top prospects, which leaves the vast majority of players and the players who most need protection right where they are now. Doesn't do anything to solve the problems that exist in college sports right now.
Yeah, it really doesn't. I think it's a noble effort, and I applaud them for it. I think the answer might be more along the lines of what Northwestern did a few years back when it was attempting to unionize the football players. Of course, it went nowhere. That's the way it is right now. But, you know, I think that players are finding their voice on the college level as well, and they're realizing that they're getting nothing while the colleges get rich. Their coaches certainly get rich. You know, sure, it's a good start, but it's not going anywhere right now.
It reminds me of a no trade clause, right? Teams can just say, oh, we don't give those out.
Right.
And then if you want to play for that school, you want to play for that team, you either, you know, acquiesce or you go somewhere else. And I sense that for the big schools, if they just say, you know, we don't give out those kinds of agreements, if players really, really want to go there because that is still their easiest or clearest path to pro sports, they're still going to go there. I think it's going to fall largely on smaller schools that are trying to get bigger recruits. And the thing about it is that it forces players to really sort of band together if they want this to go anywhere, right? And I don't know if that's going to be able to happen. So it's going to wind up being the schools, you know, that make the decision on who gets it and who doesn't. And I'm going to guess if anyone, very, very few people get this.
Yeah. As I was thinking about this morning, all I could think of is the idea of, oh, a school might give it to, say, their top recruit at the quarterback position, right? But they're not going to give it to all the guys on the offensive line who are using their bodies to protect his, you know?
Right.
And that's what really worries me about this, is that, you know, we really need all sports injuries to be covered for college athletes, not just the sports injuries of the few stars. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Julie DeCaro from Chicago's 670 The Score and Cindy Boren from The Washington Post. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
Most people know about Muhammad Ali's most famous fights, the Rumble in the Jungle, the Thriller in Manila. But today we're going to look back at two bouts that are far less well known. Only a Game's Shira Springer has our story.
My dad met his match when he had me. Okay, that's the funny thing. My father met his match and he knew it.
Leila Ali can laugh about it now, but being Muhammad Ali's youngest daughter wasn't easy. That's because Leila is a lot like her dad. She's passionate, confident, charismatic, opinionated, strong-willed, fearless, and she hates backing down from a fight. So they clashed. The first big fight happened when Leila Ali was 7 years old.
I remember pretty much waking up early in the morning because we had to pray. And as a kid, that alone was like, why do I have to do this? Like, why do I have to wake up? Why do I have to wake up out of my bed, pray to God? So, and I'm going to the mosque. Like, why do the women need to sit behind the men? All of that just didn't feel natural to me. And I felt like whatever's in my heart is in my heart. I don't care how old I am.
She knows now that her father put everything on the line for his religion. But that's not something little kids understand. Muhammad Ali converted to Islam in 1964. 2 years later, citing his religious beliefs, he filed for conscientious objector status and refused to support the Vietnam War. He was arrested, found guilty of draft evasion, and stripped of his boxing titles.
I'm a Muslim. I'm with 600 more million who believe the same as me, and I'm just sticking to my religious beliefs in the Holy Quran.
Just how far would you go to keep from taking up arms?
I'll die.
A legal battle followed. Muhammad Ali didn't fight for nearly 4 years. A little more than a decade later, Leila Ali made her stand against Islam.
My father and I, at a very young age, had to deal with the fact that I didn't want to be Muslim growing up. And I remember him saying, you don't know enough about the religion. I said, I know enough. That's exactly what I know. I know enough about it to know I don't want to be it. My father was not only disappointed when I told him that I didn't want to be Muslim, he was angry.
Leila Ali left Islam and later embraced a religion she found more spiritual and less rule-bound. Her father eventually accepted her choice. So she won that battle, and that wasn't all she won.
Yeah, I definitely think my father respected the fight in me, and he saw the same fight that was in him and me, because he, even though he was fighting for different things, he was the same way. He went with what he believed in, he stood up for what he believed in, and he wasn't afraid to say it.
When she was 19, there would be a rematch after Leila Ali started boxing.
A lot of people assume it was because of my father. Like, I was that young girl in the gym with him, and I was like, oh, I want to be like my dad. But actually, I never even thought about boxing until I saw it with my own eyes, women in the ring. And I started training pretty much in secrecy. Then at a certain point, my father found out that I was training to be a boxer, and I, in fact, was planning to go pro. So he came into town, and he says, you know, here, you want to be a boxer? And I said, yes. And he let me know right away that he didn't really feel women should box. He wasn't comfortable with it. And then he said, you know, what's going to happen if you get knocked down? I was like, well, if I get knocked down, I'm going to get back up just like you did. Well, what happens if you get knocked out? Well, if I get knocked out, I don't think it's going to happen, but I'll ask for a rematch.
Muhammad Ali still wasn't convinced Leila belonged in the ring, not his baby girl. On October 8th, 1999, Leila Ali made her professional boxing debut in upstate New York, and her father was there. Leila won her first fight by knockout in 31 seconds.
After my fight, and I looked around the ring, and I locked eyes with my father, and I looked in his eyes because, you know, my father doesn't have to say much. It's just a look that he gives you, and I saw happiness in him, and I saw that he enjoyed the moment. So it was just like he was in that moment with me. He knows what it feels like to be in a ring. He knows what it feels like to have thousands of people watching you and having all this pressure on you to perform well. And he knows what it feels like to win. My father came to my dressing room and he gave me a hug and he gave me a kiss. And I looked at him because I'm like, what's he going to say now? And he was like, girl, you bad. Meaning you're good. Girl, you bad. He was kind of living through me a little bit as I danced around the ring like he used to.
Muhammad Ali went to as many of his daughter's fights as he could, even as his health declined because of Parkinson's disease. And he liked what he saw.
Our style in the ring, the way I move around the ring, of course, I'm not comparing it to my father, but there's a lot of similarities there because our body types are the same. And I knew that he was loving the Ali chant every time that he came into the arena. You know, he missed boxing. He missed being able to just move around, walk around, talk, do the things that he used to do. Because of his Parkinson's disease, he wasn't able to anymore. So I felt like I was fighting for both of us.
And the boxing icon who once thought women didn't belong in the ring gave his daughter advice, fighter to fighter.
My father had a really great jab, fast, lightning fast. And he came up to me and he says, you know, you got to pretend there's a fly on the bag and you're trying to hit it before it flies away. And that really stuck with me. Like, that's how fast you need to try to throw your jab. You know, because otherwise you're like, okay, I'm just throwing my jab, pap, 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 hitting the bag, pap, pap, pap. You're not really thinking, pap. Like fast, 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 like trying to hit a fly. So just that visual that he gave me was really helpful. And I actually did start using it. Of course, my jab wasn't as fast as his.
Exceptional outburst there by Leila Ali. A big right hand behind the jab. She wore down.
During her boxing career, Leila Ali won multiple world titles. She retired in 2007, undefeated. Now, she's a fitness and wellness expert and television host, encouraging people to live healthier. Her father died last June.
Not too long ago, I said, Mom, you know, I said, do you really think Daddy was really, really proud of me? Or do you think he was just trying to make me feel good? Like, girl, you're bad and all that kind of stuff. She's like, no, your dad really was proud of you. And she's like, you changed his mind about boxing and women in sports. And then she's like, that was big because you know your father, he's very hard-headed. And I was like, you're right. I did. You're right. I won that battle against Muhammad Ali.
For Only a Game, I'm Shira Springer.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week on Only a Game, Bill Littlefield will be back with the story of Mack Brady, a young soccer goalie whose legacy lives on at Penn State. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
We have two new champions to talk about, so I'm going to let you pick your own adventure. Which first, Penguins or Warriors?
Let's go to the Penguins
all
first.
All right.
Because I was a big fan of the Nashville Predators, and I feel very, and they now know what having me as a fan feels like.
On Sunday, the Pittsburgh Penguins became the first NHL team to win back-to-back championships in almost two decades. So the question of the day is, were the Pens just better than the Preds, or was it all about Mario Lemieux and his lucky checkered blazer?
See, I don't buy that as a blazer. That's a houndstooth sport coat, okay? Blazers are blue, okay, as anybody who went to Catholic school will tell you. But I think it's more the fact that they have the best team in the league and are going to have the best team in the league next year, too.
A record 650,000 people showed up for Wednesday's parade, which is roughly 250,000 more than showed up last year. So that's a pretty big bandwagon, eh?
Yeah, and it's. I hope they're going to add another car to it because they're going to need it next year.
Charlie, I have a message for you and other Predators fans and players. It comes from a girl named Wrigley.
Hi, Preds. I'm sorry we didn't win. I know you said and I said too. But you shouldn't be sad, because you did great. I'm so proud of you. I love you guys. Go Preds!
Does Wrigley have it right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, she does.
Are you proud of the Preds,
I'm proud
too?
I'm proud of the Preds, too, yes. Well, that was just adorable. There's entirely too much adorable in hockey these days.
The Golden State Warriors made quick work of the Cleveland Cavaliers. They've now won two of the past three NBA titles, and the New York Times has declared them the villains of the NBA. Wait, I thought the Warriors were supposed to be the good guys.
Oh, this whole thing is this nonsense about why Kevin Durant went out there to win a championship. He went out there to win a championship to win a championship, and he did it. And this idea that he owes something to the other fans in the league, much less to the people in Oklahoma City, to stay where he was and be constantly frustrated by this team. I don't understand this part at all, but this seems to be the logic behind the story.
Warriors owner Joe Lacob says he's willing to do whatever it takes to hold on to Stephen Curry, who's up for a contract extension this offseason, which kind of makes me wonder if Steph's sitting at home thinking of ridiculous demands he could make just for the fun of it.
Well, considering he's eligible right now for a five-year, $205 million extension, I think Steph can let his imagination run a bit wild if he wants to.
The NCAA has suspended Louisville basketball coach Rick Pitino for 5 games for failing to notice that strippers were being offered to recruits during visits. The school will also lose scholarships and will vacate wins. Louisville is appealing, saying the punishments are too harsh. What says Judge Pierce?
I don't know. I mean, the people who should be shaking in their shoes right now, given the harshness of this particular decision, are the people at the University of North Carolina, who are the next ones tied to the railroad tracks with this train coming down for that academic fraud scandal, which at least we know what to call. We don't know what to call. I mean, what do we call this? And of course, Louisville, in one of its replies, defended itself by saying that the prostitutes weren't that expensive.
Oh,
so
good.
This has really been a mess.
The annual congressional baseball game went on more or less as planned on Thursday. This was after Louisiana Republican Steve Scalise was shot on Wednesday morning during a practice. Nearly 25,000 people showed up to watch, and I understand you were watching it on TV.
I watched it on the live broadcast on C-SPAN, which is right up there with those years when public broadcasting used to broadcast Ivy League football on weekends. Cedric Richmond, by the way, a congressman from Louisiana, pitched and went 3-for-4 for the Democrats, who won 11-2. Cedric Richmond can deal, by the way, for a congressman. He really can.
The MMA and boxing worlds are abuzz now that there's finally a deal for a Conor McGregor-Floyd Mayweather fight, which, it should be pointed out, will be strictly boxing, no mixing of the martial arts, and that would seem to favor Mayweather. What do you think?
I think it probably will. I think McGregor probably will stand in there and go, if not the distance, very close to the distance. My instinct tells me it's going to be a big, fat disappointment. But the hype leading up to it is going to be extraordinary. It's going to be like WWE hype without a fixed outcome.
And finally, Charlie, the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, that's a minor league baseball team, not a menu item, ran an interesting Father's Day promotion. On Thursday, they handed out free pregnancy tests, saying the tests will let the men know if they should return to the game on Father's Day Sunday. And just when you thought minor league baseball couldn't get any weirder.
Why didn't they hand these out on Mother's Day? You know, the fathers are liable to use it to stir the beer. This doesn't make any sense to me at all. Come on, Jacksonville, get with the program.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins Bill each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
What's the best way to make sure you never miss a minute of Charlie Pierce or any of the great stories on Only a Game? Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, leave us a review. We'd like to know what you think. Plus, it really does help other listeners find our show. Like a lot of kids who grew up in New Jersey in the 1950s, Ed Lucas was a baseball fan. But unlike the kids he played sandlot ball with, Ed had limited vision. Doctors had warned his parents that the slightest jolt to the head could take away his eyesight completely. Still, baseball would shape Ed's life in ways that he never could have imagined. Ed Lucas and his son Chris tell Ed's story in their own words.
Up until 1958, there was 3 New York baseball teams, the New York Giants, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the New York Yankees. My father was, he worked nights, but when we were able to watch baseball together, I would have the radio on, he would have the TV on with another game, and then we would switch back and forth to see what's going on. So we would follow all 3 teams. I came home from school on October the 3rd, 1951, to watch the playoffs between the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants. The Giants hadn't won the pennant since 1937, something like that. So I came home, the Giants were losing. My father was very upset.
The Giants
Bobby Thompson hit a home run off of Ralph Branca. My father went crazy, yelling out the windows and pulled the dishes out of the closet to make dinner, and he dropped them. So I just said to him, I have my baseball glove, I'm going out. And I was a left-handed pitcher. Took my glasses off because I felt I could see better without them. And I threw a pitch, and a line drive came back and hit me between the eyes. And that was the last thing I ever saw. I have what they call a detached retina. I was completely in the dark. When we would go to New York and I would see these blind people begging, and I vowed that I would never, never do that. My mother wrote letters to the manager of the New York Giants, Leo DeRocher, and she wrote to him saying that maybe he could have someone send me an autograph or something just to cheer me up. And she was surprised to receive a letter from Leo saying that, "I want you to bring young Ed over to the Polo Grounds. We'll give him a day." So on June 14th, 1952, I went to the Polo Grounds and I went into the clubhouse and sat in Leo DeRocher's chair, and he came in and I said, "Mr. DeRocher, will I be going out to see the ball players on the field?" He said, "No, sir." My heart dropped. He said, "You're my guest, and they have to come here and see you. And if they don't, they'll hear from me." And before I knew it, every one of those ball players started walking into his office and brought in little bottles of Coke. And it was a day I'll never forget. It gave me the impetus to go on. In those days, the ball players had to work. They weren't making millions of dollars as they are today. Phil Rizzuto, who was a shortstop for the New York Yankees and had won the MVP in the American League, he was in a clothing store as a greeter. My mother went over and spoke to him. He came over and met me, and before I know it, he called me up and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Nothing. So I'm going to be over in a half hour and take you for a ride." We went out and he would just take me for a ride. Then later on, he would come to high school, the New York Institute for the Blind, and he was very excited when I got accepted into Seton Hall University. He would, you know, have me over at the stadium doing interviews for the radio station at Seton Hall WSRU.
We have with us now, I guess the only way to describe him is the greatest ball player in baseball today and since 1951, Mickey Mantle. How are you, Mick?
Well, I'm not feeling too good today. I've got a little virus I came up with yesterday, and I don't think I'm going to play today either.
Well, Mickey, through the years you've been playing...
One of the people at the Polo Grounds said to me, "Ed, you're always talking about interviewing the players." I said, "Yes." He said, "Bring your tape recorder over." And my uncle, he carried the big Pentron tape recorder, not the small ones that you can have in your pocket today, but this was, he had to carry it in two arms. And they had to plug it in the dugout. And so I did an interview with Willie Mays in the last game of the season, the Polo Grounds, before they left. And I had never met him before. And he came over and he sat on the bench and he sat there like, you know, this is my friend. And all of a sudden I hear somebody walking back and forth on the wooden floor in the dugout. And I heard them say, "When's this young kid going to get out of here?" He said, "I got to get a photo for the AP before the game." And I thought, gee, I may never, never be able to talk to Mays again. So I just kept on talking. I didn't worry about the AP guy.
This is Pee Wee Reese. If you want the inside story from the baseball world, listen to Ed Lucas, Around the Bases, over WSOU.
Because somebody else would hire me. You know, I would let them know that I was blind. And right away, well, how can a blind person follow baseball? What can he do? I have the radio on, and I have an earpiece on, and I'm listening to the game, but I can visualize the field. When he says hit the shortstop, I can see where the ball is being hit in my mind's eye, and or fly ball to center, whatever it may be. After a while, I can hear where the ball is being hit. I can't tell you how, but many of the ball players marvel at the fact that I could tell them, hey, that ball was hit the left field, or that ball was hit the shortstop, or whatever. I got married and had two children, Ed and Chris. And my wife, she wasn't too happy because I wasn't making the kind of money that her brother was were making. And we did buy a house, but she wasn't happy enough with it. And one day I came home from work and she said, "I'm leaving." I said, "What about the boys?" She said, "You can have them," and walked away.
I am Christopher Lucas. I'm actually the son of Ed Lucas. You hear people ask someone who grew up in poverty, and they always say to them, "What was it like being poor?" And the most common response you hear is, "We didn't know we were poor." Same thing. I didn't know that my dad was disabled, that we were missing out on anything, because You know, we were having this amazing life and doing all these amazing things with him. We'd be driving over there to go to the game and, say, listening to Billy Joel on the radio. And during school that day, they'd be talking about President Nixon. And we'd get to the ballpark and who'd be sitting at the table with us for dinner but Billy Joel and Richard Nixon. You know, at the time, it was not as common as it is today to have a single-parent family. So I guess around the time I was 9, 10, 11 years old, I started realizing that there was a piece sort of missing there. And that just coincided with the time when my mother decided to come back and sue my dad for custody.
The judge said, Mr. Lucas, he said, either you give your two boys to their mother and a new husband, or I will put them in separate foster homes. He said, now you make the choice. So, of course, I would never want them to be put in the foster home, so I said, I'll give them to their mother.
I was 10 years old when the first ruling came down, and we found out that we had to leave my father after that was the only life I had known, and suddenly being ripped away from him. And to think about it, you know, it's still hard to remember those days, but a lot of people would have given up.
First, I got a new lawyer. He didn't give me much hope. He said the odds of a blind person winning custody of their children is very, very slim. Phil Zudo testified for me. He was a nervous wreck. He said, I've never been in court before in my life, Lucas. But September 25th, 1980, I was granted custody of my boys.
Where else would we go? We went to Yankee Stadium. It was Reggie Jackson hit a home run that night, and Goose Gossage was another guy that he's in the Hall of Fame now. He testified for my father. He gave a deposition. So all these guys, when we got there, they had heard already. They'd been on the road when the verdict came down. And as soon as we walked into the clubhouse, it became a party. It became everybody coming over to my dad, congratulating me and my brother. It was, if you're going to celebrate, that's the way to do it in the Yankees clubhouse.
Oh, it was great, just that my friends were all hugging me and congratulating me, and that, you know, they were supporting me all the way, not only in the custody thing, but also in baseball and being a reporter. They respected me at that time as a reporter and allowed me to interview them and give me private interviews.
Even as an adult, there's not a day in my life where I let myself say, oh boy, forget it, you're behind the eight ball, you should get... I just look at my father and I say... Oh, look at all he's gone through. How can I possibly ever say, oh, no, that's it, throw in the towel? His story is everyone's story. Every single person in life is going to face an obstacle or face a challenge. And if he can get through it, then you can get through it, too.
I can tell all stories about Yogi Berra, Phil Rizzuto, Mickey Mantle, George Steinbrenner. Good stories. I don't try to knock anybody. Baseball took my sight, but also gave me a life.
Ed Lucas won an Emmy in 2009 for his work with the New York Yankees Yes Network, and he's been inducted into the New Jersey Sports Writers Association Hall of Fame. Ed and Christopher Lucas have collaborated on a book called Seeing Home, The Ed Lucas Story. This segment originally aired in April of last year, but we thought it was just the thing to bring back for this Father's Day weekend. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler, Gary Wallach, and me, with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Philip Goldberg. Our final word comes from Layla Ali, with an assist from Shira Springer.
I'm a chip off the old rock. Is that what they say?
Old block.
Okay, see, I always get the sayings wrong.
Well, I guess that's one thing she didn't inherit from her father. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield will be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.